Third hour in a series talking about the moral evaluation of war. What is afoot in the universe for our purposes is changing opinions and conceptions on that question. And my task, especially for this hour, is that of a reporter. And because what I'll be doing is reporting, it's, I think, a little more easy to run rather rapidly over a number of things, none of them really demanding a lot of explanation or debate once we have them lined up in a row. And that's why the board is already full of slogans that I'll be explaining as I go along. But for the people here who weren't with the first 2 hours, and those who were but want to review it before we go on, we looked at the various logically possible ways of thinking about war morally, giving a blank check for whatever the authorities do, or believing that it is a very special holy cause dictated by a God to his followers, and I think we settled, as one can in such a brief survey, on the claim that if there is any morally admissible grounds for killing fellow human beings, it has to be under stated conditions and for specific reasons by specific authorities and by specified means to keep it from being a blank check. That is the alternative of simple national selfishness, the alternative of the crusade, are not morally worthy if we affirm the unity of the human race under one Creator God, and if we grant the relativity of any civil authority, including one's own nation. That means that the just war discipline, and that's a code term for a large package of ideas, is the one whose history we have to follow through the Christian West from the 4th century. It is the only show in town. That is, it's the only way you can claim to be morally discerning about war, if you make that claim at all. And what we saw, especially through the preceding hour, Tuesday, was that the restraint which that theory is in principle capable of, that is, intellectually it's capable of drawing lines, saying such a war would be justified and such a war or such a weapon would not, that restraint died away over the centuries. There were some moves in the other direction, affirmative moves. More, however, had the effect of selling out or undercutting the possibility of that just war reasoning process, its capacity effectively to restrain violence and to defend the human dignity of people on the other side of a conflict. We saw that the social phenomenon, which was described in various dimensions as making war total about 2 centuries ago, was kind of the end of that degeneration. Before that, the Protestant Reformation had weakened the critical ability of the just war theory, and other things do as well. And now we're going to be looking at what happens more recently that works in the other direction. And I'll be doing it, as I said, rapidly with just slogans to put us on the map, more or less chronological, not absolutely, with the accent and the time we'll spend on these matters at the bottom of the first column of the slogans you see there. First of all, in the very broadest sense, philosophers and political thinkers start coming up with visions for a world order. That is, what if, now that we have nations that claim to be sovereign, those nations would get together and arrange to have some kind of a federation? Philosophers in royal courts thought about things like that as early as the 15th century. It came along at least every 2 or 3 generations that someone would publish a book on a vision of how all of the nations of Europe might federate and have a kind of parliament and a kind of supreme court to keep the peace. The philosopher Immanuel Kant projected such a vision. Our colonial leader William Penn had such a vision, and there were people before and people after them. That's really within the just war framework, because obviously this kind of world federation or European federation of Christian heads of state would have to have some kind of of central power to adjudicate conflicts and to keep people from going to war when they shouldn't. So it was a just war vision, and it continues to be the case, so that's ahead of the outline here, that in the social teachings of the Vatican, the councils and the popes, it would still be desirable to have a central world order. And if there were a world order capable of adjudicating conflicts, then it would be morally wrong to have wars. That shows on the edge of any Catholic, contemporary Catholic discussion about war. The next point I'll make much more briefly because I know less about it, but there was a generation of artists, the graphic artist Goya, the literary artist Tolstoy, who beginning in the early 19th century made much of the horror of war and the stupidity of war and the desirability of having some way of living together without it. Also it's in Victor Hugo, and the whole 19th century art world had its strand of anti-militarism. The peace societies are something that we know very little about, and pay very little attention to, although the record is clear. In the early decades of young America, with the settlement of the problem of religious establishment to the effect that there would be no one denomination with state support for the whole 13 states or the further states to be formed in the West, and with notions of freedom of movement and freedom of communication that were somewhat novel, going beyond earlier European models, there developed the phenomenon of free association, much more widely practiced than people had thought of. So people would set up societies for anything. They'd set up societies to send Bibles to the Indians, or societies to send missionaries to the Indians, or societies to teach the children of immigrants English. And they set up peace societies. That is, there were people who voluntarily got together to talk about the wrongness of war and the rightness of doing something else at the points where war happens. And these grew on the American seaboard, especially from 1810 to 1836. The biggest one was consolidated in 1836 with the major units in New York, Boston, Philadelphia. They didn't last long, but it was partly from this voluntary movement that came the abolition movement. For a time, the same people were both the peace societies, or they used the word non-resistant, taking it from Matthew 5, and the abolition societies. A man named Garrison, especially, founded societies and edited journals in both. He circulated the same journals from the same press over the same mailing list part of the time, but gradually the abolition movement moved toward war, and the non-resistant movement became aware that it wasn't doing anything about the slavery issue in the short run, so that the two strands separated. The abolition movement got its war, and the peace movement dwindled into being forgotten by the turn of the century. The First Vatican Council was the first effort for centuries, since the 16th century, of the Roman Catholics of the world to get together to face the modern world. It met in Rome in 1870. On the agenda for that event was a proposal made especially by Western bishops, especially from England, to the effect that the whole Roman Catholic communion should state that modern war is immoral. And there should be an office set up at Rome to apply this conviction by looking at all future wars and explaining at what point a case could be made for them and when not, so that there could be developed a kind of body of wisdom and law to implement the awareness that modern law had got out of control. It was no longer morally acceptable. There hasn't been enough history study done to figure out where that idea came from, which particular war provoked which particular bishops to make that proposal. And anyway, nothing came of it because war broke out. That is, the Franco-Prussian War broke out, and the Vatican Council had to end. And they had only dealt with their first agenda item, namely the infallibility of the Pope, and then all the bishops had to go home, and the rest of the agenda was forgotten. So it was forgotten, but that it's that early, and that's what matters. As early as 1870, when the worst wars in history had been those of Napoleon and the American Civil War, already people were saying modern war is not morally acceptable. Insightful people responsible for the just war heritage in its Catholic form. The only other use one sees of the just war idea clearly in the 19th century is that people who were against the government on a particular war would then say it's unjust and trot out the criteria. The War of 1812 did not have the support of New England. So there's a sizable body of preaching and public statement making by the clergy of New England saying that this war is not just. And they dig around in the history to know what the criteria are for a just war and why the War of 1812 did not meet those criteria. And the people who criticized the war against Mexico in the 1850s also said that. And there, some of them were people who turned out later to be well known, including Abraham Lincoln and Henry David Thoreau. So it was possible to use the notion of a war's not being just, not meeting the just war criteria, if you were against a particular war in a democracy. But it was never applied in such a way as to govern the waging of the war or whether you would go to war. The next phenomenon that does make a great change is the development of a series of international negotiations issuing in treaties about the treatment of the wounded and then of other prisoners and then other matters having to do with the prosecution of hostilities. Issuing in two sets of treaties signed at The Hague in 1899 and 1907, and that corpus, that body of treaty law about how to fight is still building up and is largely respected by the major Western nations when they can afford to do so. It has its limits. If the party you're fighting with did not sign those conventions, are you then bound to respect them? Well, right away at that time, the British had a war in South Africa with the Boers, and the Boers didn't even exist as nations, as far as the British were concerned, because they were insurgents. And obviously, they hadn't signed the Hague Convention. So the British said, we don't have to respect the Hague Convention. We'll treat the Boers and their wives and children as enemies and not as civilians, and we have no obligations for how we treat that occupied territory. A similar question arose as late as the Second World War because Japan had not signed these treaties, not being a modern Western nation yet, and it made no sense in the Japanese frame of reference to promise to take good care of prisoners. Because according to the Japanese military mythology, you never surrender. So you'll never be prisoners. So you have no interest in guaranteeing that your soldiers will be taken good care of when they're prisoners. That notion of professional soldiership, so that a soldier will be treated well, therefore he'll surrender sooner and live to fight again, that has to do with professional soldiery in the European model in the 19th century. But it didn't make sense to the Japanese, who expected to go down fighting. And didn't want to be burdened with taking good care of anybody else's, the other people's soldiers, if they surrendered sooner. So Japan hadn't signed those treaties, and Japan felt no obligation morally to take that kind of care of the prisoners they took in the Second World War. Actually, they sometimes did better than they said, but they didn't acknowledge any obligation to treat them according to the Hague Convention. So how treaties work is always dependent on the ethos of the diplomats, on the mood of the people who make treaties and decide whether to keep them. But at least that body of prescriptions is there, and it makes very precise statements about how you treat occupied territories, what constitutes a blockade, how you treat surrendered people, how you treat hospitals, how you let the Red Cross bring packages to your prisoners, and other things that really do make a difference in whether there is any humanization possible once you've decided to have a war. World War I was a kind of acting out of the drama of thinking that war is wrong. And as President Wilson was elected twice on the grounds that he would not go to war. And his first Secretary of State was a pacifist, William Jennings Bryan. When then that position was no longer tenable because of the rising polarization across the Atlantic and both the British and the Germans acting in such a way as to draw us in, there had to be a kind of overcompensation. So instead of just going to war because you can't help going to war because it is truly a matter of last resort, it had to be inflated as a holy cause. It was a war to end war. The one reason we go to war once more is that it'll be the very last time there ever will be a war, because we'll set up the League of Nations, which will be this world order vision, finally made practical, and then we won't have any more wars. So it is a restatement of the vision that war is very wrong, but we'll just have to fight one more in order to stop it. And that was the clear understanding that Wilson himself had, until his death, of what the First World War could do. So you see, it is still a part of the concern that the wrongness of war be somehow acknowledged and taken into account in restraining measures. The last three code words on the page are closer to us now, of course, and we'll also take more attention. Hiroshima does not mean, for purposes of this outline, specifically the newness of nuclear explosives, but it means the bombing of civilian populations in major urban centers. And that didn't start with Hiroshima. It started with European cities, with the British Air Force making clear policy commitments in that direction, in disagreement with the American Air Force at the origin. It was considerably debated in the House of Commons, very little attended to in North American public life. But it had become, before the end of the war, a stated British policy that they wanted to kill large numbers of civilians, because that it was held that that would have a psychological impact on shortening the war. The worst specimens of it were, near the end, the bombing of Hamburg and Dresden. Similarly, in the Pacific theater, Hiroshima was not the first time something that bad was done. Some 6 weeks earlier, Tokyo had been the target of a firebombing, which had destroyed the whole city in a firestorm, in which more people died, and more painfully, than in Hiroshima. So the principle of city bombing is what we're talking about, and not peculiarly the use of an atomic weapon to do it cheaper. Already in 1934, the development of air technology and the breaking down of disarmament negotiations, which kept going on among the European North Atlantic nations, had brought it about that people could see that if there is another war, cities will be bombed. One graduate theology student in Catholic University of America in Washington in 1934 wrote a dissertation saying that is immoral. As far as we know, that's the first clear statement of that, worked out and spelled out, that got into the literature. It was also later printed as a book. But this was a young graduate student type. He wasn't famous. It didn't get wide attention. That opinion did get wide attention toward the end of the war, when a senior Jesuit moral theologian, John Ford, wrote an article in a prominent place saying the same thing. So before Hamburg, Dresden, Tokyo, and Hiroshima, qualified moral thinkers were saying it's wrong to bomb civilian populations. So the statement is there on paper before it happens. After Hiroshima, numerous people would respond to it simply, prophetically, with brief statements, but it didn't get extended attention for some time. There was just kind of a lag of attentiveness. But in the late 1950s, all of a sudden, that is, around something was afoot in the universe, at the same time, in various places, similar things came to be said. John Courtney Murray was the most important Catholic moral thinker in the country in this century, and he wrote an article in several different versions in 1957-58. Paul Ramsey, who just recently died this spring at Princeton, was clearly the nation's leading Protestant thinker in this field, and wrote at the same time. A study commission of the World Council of Churches had been created in 1955 and reported in 1957. And there were also similar things being said in Western Germany among the Protestants there. All of these people said at the same time, if the alternative is the bombing of cities, you should surrender. The sources to this are in one chapter of my little booklet on When War is Unjust, which is up in the bookstore. So late 50s, there was a kind of cresting of the awareness that this is just not morally acceptable. Meanwhile, of course, the nations, the Pentagon and the Kremlin and their military technicians were gearing up to make sure that the next war would be that way. But these moral thinkers, against the current of the rising arms race, were saying it would be wrong to destroy cities. That consideration, that is, the targeting of innocent populations, is what now has finally trickled out from the theologians to the bishops in the 25 years, from the late 50s to the early 80s, so that in the early part of this decade, many more people started saying that. Now, if you go back to the details of the classical intellectual structure called the just war theory, you find different ways of making the point. If you use the word discrimination, then that means you need to be able to target your weapons so that they do what you claim they're going to do, rather than enormously more or different damage. If you use the word immunity, you focus on the fact that certain people should not be destroyed. You don't have any right intentionally and directly to take civilian lives. And if you use the word proportion, it's a different kind of measurement, that the total amount of damage done must not be more than is justified by the damage you're trying to prevent. But those three together form a kind of threefold cord. One of them is procedural. You must be able to discriminate. If you can't discriminate, of course, you can't say you're not killing innocent people. And if you can't discriminate, you can't say it's not disproportionate. So the three hang together. And some people use one of those phrases and some another. But all three of them together focus on the fact that nuclear war for sure, and even city bombing in the late Second World War, cannot be morally accepted on those criteria. So the Roman Catholic bishops of the United States carried out for about 2.5 years a study process, which was described a little yesterday evening in Mel Peel's talk, which issued in May 83 in a pastoral letter, which was accepted in its fourth draft by a majority of 230-9 or something like that of the bishops of the United States. So a very strong statement saying that there can be no moral case made for nuclear armament. First of all, on the use of nuclear weapons, they reject counterpopulation use. But then they say, even if you try to start and use it only against military forces, the likelihood of escalation is so great that it's not possible to promise that it won't escalate, so you have an all-out war even if you claimed you weren't going to have it. They do grant, because the Pope had just said something to that effect, that if you already have these weapons that you don't have a right to have, maybe you have a right to keep them in order to get rid of them. And that's still being discussed. Conditioned acceptance of the retention of weapons that really shouldn't exist. But the fundamental statement is that they may, in any case, never be used explosively. Of course, you're using them all the time if you consider them as deterrent. But they may never be fired against populations. And therefore, one chunk of modern war is clearly morally unacceptable and must never happen. The World Council of Churches meets as a world assembly every 7 or 8 years, and met at Vancouver in British Columbia in 1983. And they made two different statements on the war and peace question because when their assemblies meet, they have various ways of getting documents drafted. What they said that was strongest was to ratify the recommendation of an earlier study, which had gone on also under their sponsorship, including a major meeting in Amsterdam in 1981, which finally came out and said the same thing even more sweepingly, that nuclear arms can never be morally accepted. There is no grounds on which we can claim that the possession of nuclear arms, or even their fabrication and their stockpiling, are morally acceptable. I don't catch right away the particular quotation, but the hearing statement in Amsterdam, here it was, The time has come when the churches must unequivocally declare that the production and deployment, as well as the use, of nuclear weapons are a crime against humanity and that such activities must be condemned on ethical and theological grounds. That was first made at an Amsterdam special meeting in 1981. It was confirmed by the Central Committee of the World Council of Churches, which is 100 people, in 82, and restated at Vancouver in 1983. Since then, other groups have said somewhat similar things. The United Methodist Bishops of the United States made a statement just about a year ago. So under that slogan, Hiroshima, we have one set of firm statements, which if taken literally and lived out, would mean that the just war theory is providing an instrument for effective restraint. Nuremberg is also a code word. I don't just mean the town in southern Germany, but as you know, it's the main place, although not the only place, where after the Second World War, trials were held, organized by the victorious Allies to prosecute, but fairly, that is under normal legal process, people who had committed crimes against the laws of war, crimes against peace, crimes against humanity. Those were the three legal categories. Obviously, this is victor's justice. They didn't apply the same rules to their own people and the atrocities that they themselves had committed. But it was still important that through due process of law, the mills of institutional justice ground fairly in such a way that people were innocent until proven guilty and had a right to defense, etc. But it came out that you may be prosecuted and you may be punished for having failed to refuse to commit a war crime. You may be prosecuted for failing to disobey an unjust order. Well, that's just war thinking, that there are criteria which you must respect even if you're under a government or a general who tells you to do something wrong. You must not do it. So in that sense, Nuremberg is a kind of theatrical performance on the world scale, saying international crime should not pay. Of course, it does pay if you win, but at least half the time it doesn't pay, because people can be prosecuted for committing war crimes if they're on the losing side of the war. And then, of course, a little bit in the case of some of our later experience, the trial of Lieutenant Kelly, if there is a sufficiently aroused public opinion or a sufficiently morally concerned administration, it is possible also that atrocities may be punished on your own side. But that happens much less, and it isn't really the point being made here. And lastly, what came to be called selective objection is a new phenomenon. If your government is carrying on an unjust war, what should you do about it as a citizen? Or specifically, if you're a citizen being called to serve. All the way back to Martin Luther, the idea is possible to say that I shouldn't serve. And there are two quotations from Martin Luther to that effect, which you probably haven't read very often, but they're in my new booklet. If you know that the war you're being asked to fight is unjust, you should refuse to fight, even at the cost of your life. But he doesn't expect it to happen. And there are no records of any Lutherans that did that until modern times. But the principle is there in the meaning of the just war tradition. But in the case of Vietnam, a lot of young Americans came out with that conclusion. They hadn't been helped much by their churches or by their social studies at school or wherever they're supposed to learn civil virtues, but they knew that the Vietnam War was not something in which they wanted to participate. Some of them left the country at great cost. Some of them went underground. A few of them went to jail. Others found other ways of avoiding service. By the end of the Vietnam time, the major denominations that hold formally to the just war position said, in their church leadership, that the selective objection position is a morally proper application of the just war tradition. That was said by the Roman Catholic bishops, and it was said by the Lutheran churches, the Lutheran Council in America, after discussion with the other bodies. It's a position that therefore has logical integrity. It is an application of the just war that a non-pacifist will say, I look at the Vietnam War and I ask the question of legitimate authority, or I ask the question of non-combatant immunity, or I ask the question of last resort, or I ask the question of long-range intention. I say that war doesn't meet the criteria. I shouldn't fight. The selective service law does not respect that position in American selective service legislation. But it is an honest position, and both Catholic and Lutheran authorities, by the end of the time, when it was pertinent, before it was too late to mean anything, did say that, and did take positions in principle supporting selective objection. So Hiroshima, Nuremberg, and selective, what they mean as code words, are the major points at which the just war notion is beginning to have teeth again in the modern Western world, in which we see people who are not pacifists in principle saying there are limits to what it is proper to do in the pursuit of a war. Now on the other side, the other column, these are much broader and fuzzier things. They aren't arguable in quite the same sense, but I think they're certainly part of what we report, especially if we are interested in these matters of globally changing consciousness. There's a sense in which realism, which we saw in the first hour, can be used as a code term for not taking account of anybody else's rights, is changing sides. That is, if you can't win a war, then even if you have no moral compunctions, it's dumb to fight it. And there are wars you can't win because of the nature of the terrain, because of what's at stake on the other side, or what would be left if you did win. You know, the famous phrase that came back from South Vietnam, we had to destroy the village to save it. If whatever you thought was at stake in the war cannot be won, well, then it's stupid to go on just fighting because you're a realist, because that means you aren't a realist. This is even more the case, of course, if there is any question of our own survival. And with the escalation of particularly nuclear weapons or others which reach past the immediate battle zone to the global ecology, and the prospects of global winter or global greenhouse summer or whatever else we're doing to the atmosphere, even if you had no moral compunctions, you would be stupid to blow up the world just in order to stop the Soviets if you were going to kill yourself at the same time. So realism has changed sides. Realism is now against war. If you actually count the selfish cost against the selfish benefit, well, then who's still for it? Well, it's the Rambos and the Crusaders. It's the people who believe that there's some transcendent push that is of our dignity, or some transcendent cause that we incarnate that makes us keep on. So that's on the level of the meaning of realism being changed. And now some things that are still harder to talk about that would take a different kind of speech if they were to be presented well. Still deeper reasons that more people are doubting the acceptability of institutionalized preparation for war without becoming radically pacifist, or maybe becoming pacifist for these reasons. One is that more and more people see that in a finite world economy with limited mineral and fossil resources, the more we spend on preparation for war, the less we have to feed ourselves and our grandchildren. And as long as decisions about spending on war are made by the powerful nations of the world, the imbalance between the strong and the weak nations of the world will get worse, because it's the wealthy nations spending or wasting their wealth at the cost of what could be done with that wealth for the rest of the world. So it isn't only that a militarized government is bad for its people, but a militarized world starves its poor people. And that is increasingly seen to be the case by a lot of people who would have known it before but hadn't had their noses rubbed in it the way the modern social analysis does. And then this is escalated, of course, when we begin to get at the edges of our ecology, and when we think of the possibility that nuclear pollution will itself make certain kinds of life no longer livable, or certain places no longer livable, or that just the total dispersion of nuclear wastes or the carbon dioxide drawn from fossil fuels will tilt the balances of the whole cosmic system so that continuing to work along with business as usual at the arms race will all of a sudden have leveraged or multiplied destructive effects on the whole ecology. The next two slogans I have there with question marks because they point to partly logical, partly sociological questions. You should have known it all the time, but we are increasingly seeing that you cannot impose democracy by non-democratic means. You can't use means either of which fly in the face of domestic democracy as information control and the classification of facts and some other things that happened in Washington do, or nor can you foster democracy by supporting non-democratic regimes in Chile or somewhere else. And that decreases considerably the credibility of the claim that whatever war we might fight could be a justified war. Because one thing you can't do with democracy is impose it on people from outside by force. It's by definition, that's not spirituality, that's just logic. If I impose something on you by force, it isn't democracy. And in a similar sense, there's more and more sobriety in certain circles, although this is still much more up for grabs in debate in many circles. Most revolution isn't revolutionary. Most changes of government don't change structures deeply, after all. Most seizures of power don't fix what they claimed to have to seize power to fix. I say most, it's not an absolute statement. There are places where radical political change does have long-range effects, partly for good, even then often partly for evil. But very often the claim, we have to seize power in order to make a more just world, turns out in just having a different set of oppressors. And there's increasing sobriety about that. Nonviolent analysis at the bottom of the list means not talking about ethical action, but what you look for in a society. If you think that world history is written by armies defeating other armies, then that's what you'll study, and that's the view of history that you'll get. But if you think that world history is also made by cultural exchange, by migration, by international cooperation in postal treaties and international regulation of deep sea fisheries, and the many things that actually are getting better and better organized in the world as a whole, then you can have a whole different vision of what your basic paradigm is of how society works. Is society basically like two nations at each other's throats most of the time? Or might world society sometimes be somewhat like Canada and the United States, who couldn't have a war because we aren't set up for it? Or like Washington and Oregon, who couldn't have a war because they're not set up for it. Earlier, we could have wars between states, but now we can't anymore. Or France and Germany, who can't have a war because they're not set up for it. Instead of looking at the model of utterly sovereign nations at each other's throats, why not look at the model of cooperating nations entering into increasingly binding networks of economic relations and political cooperation? That's really happening. It's not always happening for deep spiritual reasons. The European economic community is driven by capitalist selfishness, but it's still better than having Germany and France fight each other every 20 years. So there are ways to analyze the potential. It's not a world order vision like where I started, a utopian dream of a world federation, but it is a growth from the bottom of more and more cooperation, so that it's less and less meaningful to conceive of any interpeople conflict as something that could meaningfully be adjudicated by recourse to violence. And it might be that the summits of recent months, despite everything else that has been confusing about the way to manage the arms negotiation, are beginning to surface that kind of a notion, that even between superpowers, it is no longer rational to consider that the clashes between us could be adjudicated by the classical arm of trying to destroy the other nation. And then lastly, nonviolent action, which is something that we spoke of the other evening in another setting. The more it becomes thinkable that certain social causes can be served by outright non-violent action, that is, not just by not being violent, but by doing something whose effectiveness is greater because it's done without violence, like the takeover of Manila 2 years ago in February, or like some of the activities of Gandhi or King or Cesar Chavez, the more you think about that, the less quickly you will ever get to the point where the just war theory will permit you to say that you are in a situation of last resort. Last resort means you've tried everything else. Well, if you've never thought of anything else, you get right away at the point where there's nothing else. So Ronald Reagan says, our only recourse was to bomb Tripoli. He used the term last resort, bombing Gaddafi's children. That shows that the language is still wrong. But if you haven't looked for alternatives, you aren't in a situation that the just war theory calls last resort. If you develop concepts, alternative scenarios, you train leadership, you develop a body of literature, you develop songs and poetry and theater to support an alternate vision of how things happen in the world, well, then you can't know that you couldn't serve many of these valid goals, nonviolently, of which it was said before that violence is the only recourse. So all of these are different kinds of changes, different levels. The last six on the level of very broad slogans that would take a different kind of analysis. Before that, some elements of just grubby realism and selfishness, but important. And the others, cultural and social events of the last century. All of them going in the direction of a rising readiness of people and peoples, including Christians, to say that if you don't have to be pacifist, you at least have to be much less ready for war than you have been. So much for introduction. The rest is up to you.
One of my concerns, it kind of overflows from the Bible study this morning about the population, because of our large population. Also, our economy is so geared at the making of weapons or things that go into weaponry that I would like to hear some alternatives to what kind of jobs do you generate for people if we, cut down on the making of weapons because of the population that we have. It seems very difficult.
Well, anybody that lives around Seattle can understand that. But it's short-circuited. There is a body of literature prepared by economists, political economists, and business management-type people, kind of sub-discipline they call transarmament or conversion studies, who look bit by bit at that question instead of globally. We should remember that, and this has just been dramatized in Washington the last 2 weeks again, spending money on weapons is the least economically constructive way to give people jobs that we have. It would be better to throw dollars out the window and have people spend their time all day catching them at the bottom of the skyscrapers than to have all of this crony-laden, favoritist, and wasteful, non-competitive procurement process pouring money into factories. So certainly the same amount of money could give those people better work doing something we need more. It would just take reorganization to do it gradually, to include training people. Is probably the same skills that make airplanes could make prefabricated metal housing or prefabricated school buildings or something. But you'd have to go farther than that. You wouldn't just use the same machine or the same factory for something different. But just by definition, an inefficient use of highly paid people to produce something you're never going to use has to be less economically viable than anything else you could do with that money.
My understanding was that the vested interests, the arms suppliers, make billions and billions of dollars from the weapons of war and are very powerful, and I'm not at all interested in changing the system to build.
No, it's much easier. I mean, if you can have a sweetheart contract with the government that gives you billions without competition, even though you do it on the claim that you're defending the free enterprise system against communism, Pentagon procurement is really the largest socialist enterprise in the world. Yeah. So there are powerful interests, but we ought to say it that way. We shouldn't say that there wouldn't be work. And we shouldn't let labor get manipulated onto the wrong side of the question by the idea that everybody would lose jobs if we stopped making weapons.
I don't think they want people to realize that there are a lot more jobs to be had in a peacetime economy if you recycle that money and change the system, because there's too much at stake for a very few people.
Think of all the people you could have fixing the trails up here at Holden if they weren't.
There have been two artists that have had a profound impact on my thinking. One was Picasso in his Guernica, and the other Benjamin Britten in his War Requiem. And I think they both, I would hope, had something to do with the change of attitudes in the development of the flow that you were in.
Yeah, I would think
and
so.
And I think that when you mentioned the Via, I felt compelled to mention that. Yeah. Just those two works.
Mm-hmm.
Well, contrary to that, I didn't know that art really changes viewpoints. The Guernica, I don't think it preached to the converted more or less. I don't think you had many people that were warmongers and saw them that would have changed their view.
Well, at least it would deepen the understanding or the add a dimension to the converted. I suspect people reading Tolstoy, it was the same thing. If you're ready to see that it's an atrocity, then you read War and Peace and you see that it really is an atrocity. If you aren't ready to listen, then you're not going to read all those pages.
Is there any work of art that would speak to the people that are not?
I think that's an ongoing dialogue. It's hard to find things that art isn't as powerful as I used to think it was.
Maybe the Vietnam War. I wonder. I haven't seen that wall myself, but
yeah.
I understand that people that do are just overcome that.
I was at the Jewish Center in Toledo a couple months ago and wept at the Holocaust Memorial. Spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd even been to some of the chambers in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that was bad enough, but that artwork would just happen to me. So I think art is powerful. Even to the non-committed.
Yeah.
Right? They're sensitive. They have to have amounts of sensitivity.
Well, one thing I haven't dealt with at all is the problems of communicating so that you convert people, whether it's by art or by rational debate or by something else. I've just described the content of the change of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, this raises question: how are you going to teach it to your own kids? How are you going to teach it to the adversaries within your own community? And how it gets communicated is a whole different agenda from the substance that I've been talking about here.
I was going to say, art has a very positive influence. A lot of people think, you know, a nuclear war, we're protecting a way of life, but really, what have we to live for? And I think art sort of brings joy and meaning,
mm-hmm.
even if it doesn't preach a message.
Mm-hmm. But it also seems to me extremely important that as adults, we need to press for honesty in our history books. I mean, there's a whole generation of kids growing up that have no history of the Vietnam conflict. Kids who've lost fathers and brothers, and it's not in the history books. Why isn't it?
Because they're waiting for all those people to die so they can write it the way they want it to be written.
Well, I think now then if we're talking about how things can change, I mean, I think that we all have individual responsibilities in our individual community to press for that kind of honesty in our school board.
Not only to get it into the history books, but to get to that point. I remember being so frustrated at the college level, even of not getting past, like about 1900 was the end of the history that we were taught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and particularly in high school, it is. It just part is not taught and needs to be in order for any kind of sensitivity to ever grow in a new generation.
Well, I see a desire to rewrite history in Vietnam anyway, in those Rambo movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's rewriting history.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that would be something in our discussion about what art can do, might study it some depth. There are Vietnam movies, and there are Vietnam movies. Some of them make the drama at least somewhat tangible as awful and dirty, and others just make heroic.
This is the first meeting I've ever been. They didn't discuss this, so I'm an innocent. And I think when you get someone who's not familiar with what you're talking about, the first year, I think I'm asking a question where everybody's going to groan because I'm asking a sophomore question. So when you go to educate a newcomer, you have to be open. Because my question is, and I know it's sophomore, is do pacifists believe in any deterrent at all? Because my mindset with the people I know is we need a deterrent. And I want to know what the deterrent is to protect our way of life. Or are we thinking of a global government? I don't understand that. Where do we go after we lay down our weapons?
No, well, that's not at all sophomoric. It's not something that this particular outline meant to look at.
Something I need to know, though, when I leave here.
Yes and no. I mean, it's a very fruitful way of putting the question. If it should be the case that the only way to save some value, I think, is important, is to blow up the rest of the world, then I don't think I need reassurance about who's going to save that value for me before I decide not to blow up the rest of the world. So it depends on the scale of these stakes, whether we have a right to ask that all our values be saved and that before we give up on doing the thing that is awfully destructive. So on the maximum logical level, maybe we should stop our plans to do evil before we have an alternative. But many of the people I've been talking about would believe that we have the wherewithal for developing alternative ways of defending our values. If we would study more at the far extreme, nonviolent techniques for defense of your values, more of the people I've been talking about here, like the Roman Catholic bishops, believe we must commit ourselves never to use these weapons, but we can have them around for a while for diplomatic purposes as bargaining chips in order to get rid of them. And the Methodist bishops as well said we can still have conventional armed forces in order to guard the middle of Europe in case the Soviets will do something that we hope they never will. So you have a whole scale of people, from some who would say you must trust the Lord and just determine not to do evil, and others who would say we can do a much more effective preservation of our values by renouncing the pure means. There's a whole spectrum from one end to the other.
I was thinking of our other wars, you know, besides nuclear. And I'd like to see us go back and study the prophets, as when people become oppressors, you know, the chosen people that were led out of Israel were also led into Babylon. But I look at El Salvador, and I look at the different places. The fact that we're the world's number one military arms salesman, and that, you know, our national debt or trade balance, rather, is balanced basically by making sure that other people buy weapons. You know, I think we need to look and say, what value, you know, do we have in promoting these wars? How does that support our way of life? Each of us, whether we're in a military job or not, is our way of life supported by this continuing wars in other places? They don't hurt us, we're not the civilians being attacked, but we do benefit.
I think that would be another point to add to the list under New Realism. You don't have to be morally sacrificial to say that it's in the long range bad business to be selling arms to both sides of the third world for them to kill each other, and it can't in the long range be supporting your own values. That's one kind of thing. I think another part of what you were saying at the beginning was that what if there are times and places where, despite our best intentions as a democratic, freedom-loving nation, we're actually on the wrong side of some local controversy by supporting the bad guys because of our other networks of interest and commitments. How are we going to talk to ourselves about that? Of course, you don't have to be pacifist to raise that question. You just have to be honestly democratic, but it's hard to do in our society.
Well, I think that's a good point.
One more comment?
I'd be interested to hear how you, the popularity of Oliver North really surprised me. I don't know, maybe I, but how would you describe that? Yeah. Is that the old realism coming up again?
No, if you were listening critically, you noticed that I changed my outline a little. I started saying there are four logically possible ways to look at war. You may be a realist who just says you do what you want to. You may have a divine mandate, call it a crusade. You may use these careful categories of what justifies a war, or you may reject it all. There is a fifth position that I'm giving more attention to now than 5 years ago. And for that, I use the name Rambo as a symbol. That is, a sense that there is a distinctive kind of not only pride and not only macho self-respect, but a kind of compensation for indignity, a kind of setting things right in a world where the other guys have had it long enough. And that's a large part of the American psyche. So that when North believes that it's all right to commit crimes and to deceive his boss and the whole country in the name of his boss and the whole country, somehow that looks heroic instead of stupid. And I think Rambo is the American word for fascist. But it has a certain appeal and a certain heroic integrity for somebody who's frustrated by more complicated analyses and who feels that somehow we're the good guys and we haven't been winning. And we pay somebody a lot of millions to make films like that, to let us experience vicariously the fact that we win by breaking more rules and more heads than anybody else. And that's really a part of our national psyche. It isn't just a fluke. There's too much of a market for it to call it a fluke.
Thank you.